troops withdraw from Ukraine. Not sooner, not later. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. So any peace, any proposed peace deal must involve that. And it doesn't sound to me very likely that a peace solution could have been reached at any point in the first months of the war, while the Russian army was occupying large chunks of Ukraine, which then the Ukraine, if Ukrainians were pushed into a peace deal, for example, in summer last year, they would have been they would have had to concede large chunks of their territory, which they later liberated. So it doesn't seem very likely to me that a peace deal could be reached by, could be negotiated by some third party last year. And I don't think it's ethical for anyone to claim credit for the effort. Any peace resolutions that don't involve the Ukrainians, and it's just let's have the Americans and or the British or someone else negotiate a peace deal, or blame someone else for torpedoing such a peace deal. That would any peace deal of that kind would involve, Ukraine conceding parts of its territory
Alexei,
to the aggressor.
We have to break now,
Russia.
But we're going to bring part two of this conversation at democracynow.org. Alexei Kovalev, investigative editor at Medusa. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website
Welcome
at kboo.fm to verify if the meeting
is
being
host,
held.
Margaret Prescott, on December 9th, 1981. Journalist and Black Panther Party member Mumia Abu-Jamal was arrested for the alleged killing of policeman Daniel Faulkner in Philadelphia. In spite of surmounting evidence to the contrary, in 1982, he was convicted for wrongful death of Faulkner. And Mumia spent the next 28 and a half years in solitary confinement awaiting the death penalty. As a result of a national and global campaign to free Mumia, in 2011, Mumia was removed from solitary confinement and from death row, but continues to serve a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Today, on Sojourner Truth, we bring you voices from a press conference on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the recent amicus brief in his case filed by the UN Working Group on People of African Descent. The international body observes that racial bias has tainted the judicial process up to now, citing new evidence of innocence and misconduct by judges and prosecutors. Mumia Abu-Jamal's lawyers say evidence in boxes discovered in the Philadelphia District Attorney's office by the new Philadelphia DA, Larry Krasner, who in 2019 showed that his trial was tainted by judicial bias and police and prosecutorial misconduct, including withholding of evidence and also basically what amounted to bribing witnesses to lie. As of the airing of this show, the plea for a new trial in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal went before the Philadelphia Common Pleas Court, Judge Lucretia Clemens, on Friday, December 16th. The court was packed with majority Black and other people of color and also other supporters. Judge Clemens asked the Commonwealth if they would confirm that there is no new evidence in the 32 boxes that relate to the claims of new evidence and racism in jury selection. This is known as the Brady and Bateson claims. The Commonwealth, however, didn't confirm. So Judge Clemens suggested that Mumia's lawyers make arrangements to see those boxes. The judge said she would be making her ruling in 60 to 90 days. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Search and rescue efforts continue for a third day in Turkey and Syria as the death toll has surpassed 11,000 from a 7.8 earthquake and many aftershocks that has reduced regions to rubble. It's the deadliest quake worldwide in more than a decade. In Syria, rebel or opposition-held areas say aid is being blocked. That's where the quake is hit hardest in the north. The White Helmets have called on the United Nations to do more to provide aid. Spirits were lifted in the region after two children were rescued separately after some 40 hours under the rubble. Syria's representative to the United Nations, Sabah Basaw, is among several to accuse Western sanctions against President Assad of preventing aid from reaching the country.
Lots of the airplane, cargo airplane, refused to land on Syrian airports because of the American and European sanctions.
In Turkey, hope for finding survivors is fading with fears overnight lows will be too cold for many trapped to survive. Amid calls for the Turkish government to send more help to the disaster zone, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan toured a tent city.
On the first day, we experienced some issues, but then on the second day and today, the situation is under control. We will never allow our citizens to be left on the streets. I am asking our people not to give the provocateurs an opportunity and only pay attention to the statements coming from the Disaster Management Authority. Today is a time of unity and solidarity.
Search teams from more than two dozen countries have joined tens of thousands of local emergency personnel, and aid pledges have poured in from around the world. One of two U.S. expert urban search and rescue teams are in Turkey from the Los Angeles Fire Department, more than 80 people with six K-9 teams to help in search and rescue efforts, along with engineers. But the scale of destruction is so immense, many are still waiting for help. In the U.S., President Joe Biden struck a bipartisan tone in his State of the Union address. He teased House Speaker Kevin McCarthy he doesn't want to spoil his reputation, but looks forward to working with him, and called on Republican lawmakers to work with him to finish the job of rebuilding the economy and uniting the nation. He also introduced California resident Brandon Say as his guest for the State of the Union, where he pressed for a ban on semi-automatic weapons. Say wrestled a semi-automatic gun from a suspect in a mass shooting just minutes after the Monterey Park massacre in California last month, preventing a second tragedy that night in the nearby town of Alhambra.
In that instant, he found the courage to act and wrestled a semi-automatic pistol away from the gunman who had already killed 11 people in another dance studio. 11. He saved lives. It's time we do the same. Ban assault weapons now. Ban them now. Once and for all, in 10 years, that ban was law, mass shootings went down. After we let it expire in the Republican administration, mass shootings tripled. Let's finish the job and ban these assault weapons.
He also called for extending a new $35 per month price cap on insulin for people on Medicare to everyone in the country, and he pushed Congress to quadruple the 1% tax on corporate share buybacks that was enacted in the Democrats' climate and health care bill passed last year, known as the Inflation Reduction Act. He vowed to veto any abortion ban that reaches his desk and pledged no cuts to Social Security nor Medicare. And then he called for police reforms, as Tyree Nichols' family were in attendance. He's the man killed in Memphis, Tennessee, by five police officers who have since been charged with second-degree murder.
We also need more first responders and professionals to address the growing mental health, substance abuse challenges. More resources to reduce violent crime and gun crime. When police officers or police departments violate the public trust, they must be held accountable. I signed an executive order for all federal officers banning chokeholds, restricting no-knock warrants, and other key elements of the George Floyd Act. Let's commit ourselves to make the words of Tyler's mom true. Something good must come from this. Something good.
Members of the Black Caucus wore pins with the date 1870 on them as a sign of their demand for police reform. It marks the first known police killing of a free black man. Immigration was the topic of a House hearing yesterday where Democrats and Republicans clashed on the issue, Edwin J. Vieira reports.
U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents testified before the House Oversight and Accountability Committee about the border crisis. Democrats spoke about how more fentanyl is getting stopped at the border, but Republicans noted the number of people carrying drugs into the country is unclear. Florida Democrat Jared Moskowitz lamented the disconnect between the parties.
All we're doing in this hearing is politicizing another issue in this country that doesn't need to be politicized. We all agree that fentanyl is a problem.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the United Kingdom, where he will address legislators and the king. It comes as the UK is stepping up military aid to the country. And as Zelensky warns, Russia's preparing a major offensive to mark its one-year anniversary on the country later this month. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and now we turn to the continuing fight to free political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. A press conference held on December 13th included moderator Johanna Fernandez. She is an associate professor who has researched Mumia's case at length and is executive producer of the film Justice on Trial, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Ms. Fernandez is presently associate professor of history at Baruch College in the City University of New York. Also, the Honorable Wendell Griffin, state court trial judge in the 6th Judicial Circuit of Arkansas. Dr. Vijay Prashad, executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research in Buenos Aires, Johannesburg, New Delhi, and Sao Paulo. Julia Wright, founder of the Mumia Abu-Jamal Health Committee and board of the Richard Wright Civil Rights Center in Elaine, Arkansas. Lynn Washington Jr., a Philadelphia-based investigative reporter who has covered Mumia's case since his arrest on the morning of December 9th, 1981, as well as Mumia's grandson, Jamal Jr. Let's go to hear their voices now.
Thank you, everybody, for joining this press conference. Our matter this morning is the notice given by the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. The United Nations Working Group on Experts of People of African Descent filed an amicus brief on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal on December 6, 2022. The brief calls the Abu-Jamal case, quote, emblematic of the problems of racial discrimination faced by people of African descent living in the diaspora, unquote. Its objective is to contribute, quote, to the analysis of systemic racism vis-a-vis the criminal justice system, unquote. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther who was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death for killing white police officer Daniel Faulkner in Philadelphia. My name is Johanna Fernandez. I'm associate professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York. I'm the writer and executive producer of the film Justice on Trial, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We will first hear from Julia Wright, who's the daughter of author Richard Wright. She's the founder of the Mumia Abu-Jamal Health Committee.
This amicus brief is already a milestone abolitionist document because it has historical connections. The first connection is Mumia. Mumia Abu-Jamal is already part of our Black history, not only because of the textbook case aspect of his ordeal, not only because there are two streets in France named after him, not only because, as Lynn Washington puts it, he is a Black journalist behind bars who has written more than 95% articles compared to journalists outside and in America. Not only because he is one of our best Black writers and historians, but simply because he is beloved by the voiceless. George Floyd and how he died. Russell Maroon Schultz and how he died. George Floyd's last breath went around the world, and the worldwide protests that ensued shook the United Nations to the core. After hearing the narrative of George Floyd's brother, all 54 African states, members of the United Nations, wrote a letter of solidarity to us in our collective mourning and requested a UN investigation into law enforcement on US soil. Mumia writes that their attempts, quote, gave hope to those living on the brink in US ghettos and prisons, on death rows and beyond. So I believe this brief is inspired by the last breath of George Floyd and the global South's response to it. It is also inspired by the realization that Mumia's frame-up took place in a world where police narratives still held sway before Eric Garner and George Floyd. Today, in a post-George Floyd and a post-Uvalde world, police narratives are in the dock. I knew we needed a Mumia Health Committee, and so I gathered a group of activists to work to stop the triage, unite with other political prisoners, health committees, with a collective voice to interface with the community at large, with impacted families, with NGOs, and with the UN. Our message? Our elderly, comorbid prisoners, primarily the political ones, are subjected to a death by incarceration that is torture. So I believe this amicus, founded on the immediacy with which it was written by the working group of experts on peoples of African descent, the absence of red tape involved, the deep listening on their part, and their ability to go to the roots of the case, it is the result of their recognition that racism is a crime against humanity that cannot be time barred, that state and court decisions should be continuously reinterrogated in the light of the slavery-old harms of systemic racism, that evidence of racial bias, even decades old, has no expiry date, and that Mumia's case is the tip of a very dangerous white supremacist iceberg.
Thank you, Julia. We'll next hear from Dr. Vijay Prashad, Executive Director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, the Director of the Tricontinental, which is an institute for social research, and it has offices in Buenos Aires, Johannesburg, New Delhi, and Sao Paulo. Vijay.
It's great to be here. Obviously, I would prefer if I was in person with Mumia Abu-Jamal walking freely in the streets of Philadelphia. That would be the best case scenario. Close to that, but not exactly, is the fact that the United Nations has finally weighed in with this important amicus brief. You know, for a very long time, the United States of America has lectured the planet about human rights and democracy. It's made it a habit, in fact, of sanctioning countries that it claims are not democratic up to a certain democratic standard and so on. Over 30 countries, by the way, are under U.S. unilateral and therefore illegal sanctions. They are illegal because they're not authorized by the United Nations. The United Nations is a body that comprises 193 countries who are treaty-bound to follow the UN Charter of 1945. The UN Charter is the greatest compromise document on the planet because 193 countries are treaty-bound by that charter, and yet the charter is violated routinely. That's the reason why a number of important people from the United States submitted a text called We Charge Genocide in 1948 about the systematic attack at people of African descent inside the United States. This has a long history, this history of appealing to the United Nations. And finally, in a way, the United Nations has answered not only to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, but in fact, in a small way, to the great text called We Charge Genocide from 1948. Where does one even begin on this story? The numbers say it all. United States is well known to be the world's largest per capita incarcerator of human beings. 2 million people. That's a fact. What is there to say? Do we need to talk about the disproportionality with which people of African descent and people of Latin American descent and so on disproportionately incarcerated? Do we need to get into that? By a long shot, disproportionately incarcerated. The numbers, in fact, say it all. Obscene numbers of people killed every year by the police departments of the United States. I mean, 1,000 people a year is the official statistic. That's about 3 people a day almost. Here, close look at those statistics done by the Washington Post, a venerable institution of the United States. It shows disproportionate killing of people of African descent, people of Latin American descent, and so on. The numbers say it all. What do we have to contribute to that? It's right there on the record. It's about time somebody took those numbers seriously. Well, the people in the United States know those numbers. Punctual protests every few years on the streets for this or that killing of one individual who exemplifies the killing of thousands of people. It was Michael Brown in 2014 in Ferguson. A cycle of protest starts against police violence. And then just a few years later, the killing of George Floyd in 2020, the Black Lives Matter movement starts. Black Lives Matter, an important slogan. Almost 26 million people in the United States take to the streets. That's the largest mass demonstration in US history. In some ways forgotten. And I remember those protests. I remember seeing photographs. In the midst of those protests, Black Lives Matter, there were signs which said, Free Mumia. Free Mumia, said the protesters in the Black Lives Matter protests around the horrendous killing of a man named George Floyd. Free Mumia. What did Mumia Abu-Jamal have to do with this? His is, in fact, an individual case. 41 years incarcerated. What does it have to do with something in 2020? Well, everything. In one respect, the slogan Free Mumia is a slogan that, as the United Nations recognizes, is about the person, Mumia Abu-Jamal, unjustly sitting in a prison for 41 years. In most countries, a life sentence is about 10 to 25 years. Most countries, civilized countries in the world, do not hold people to what in the United States is known the length of their natural life. That is inhumane. That's a human rights violation. Most countries, when people are sentenced to life, it's understood to be 10 years and then parole or 25 years. 41 years, that's an atrocity. And the United Nations has recognized that. Free Mumia, it means Free Mumia. But Free Mumia also means something else. Because of the great compassion of Mumia Abu-Jamal, he has become a symbol not only of his own case, but of the case of systematic racism in the United States. Systematic racism, that phrase which one hears even from people in power in the United States. It means racism has corroded the entire system. The system lives on the basis of racism. That's what the system is. The system requires changing. A system of systematic racism lecturing the world about human rights and democracy? Stop. Look to yourself. Look to your own problems. Take seriously what the United Nations has said about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Free Mumia. That's about Mumia Abu-Jamal, the individual. Free Mumia. That's about a system that is rotten and that is desperately crying out cycle after cycle of protests. Black Lives Matter. Stop the violence. Stop police violence.
Thank you, Vijay. I think it's important to underscore that what the UN brief suggests is that there are echoes of the past, of the country's racist past in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It shocks the conscience that in the post-George Floyd world, Abu-Jamal has for 41 years been refused relief in the courts. Mumia was beaten within an inch of his life by police officers after having been shot in the stomach by Officer Faulkner. This is something that is forgotten about this case. The prosecutor, Joe McGill, bribed a testimony out of star witness Robert Chobert, who was driving with two DWIs, no license, and had been previously convicted of throwing a Molotov cocktail into a schoolyard. This is the new evidence that has emerged. A handwritten letter penned by the star witness Robert Chobert asking, "Where is my money?" The judge who presided over the case initially, Judge Albert Szabo, was overheard by a court stenographer say, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger," referring to how he was going to instruct the jury. The only thing Mumia is guilty of is having survived an encounter with the infamously brutal and corrupt Philadelphia police of the late 1970s and 1980s. And this police department was under investigation at the time by the Department of Justice for brutality, corruption, and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions. In fact, that term, shocks the conscience, is in the documents produced by the DOJ about the Philadelphia police. They said that the level of brutality and homicidal violence of the Philadelphia Police Department and its tampering with evidence to obtain convictions shocks the conscience. And we are here today again to talk about the echoes of the racist past in Mumia's case. And next, we'll hear from Lynn Washington Jr., who's a Philadelphia-based investigative reporter who has covered the Mumia Abu-Jamal matter since Abu-Jamal's arrest on the morning of December 9th, 1981.
Thank you, Dr. Fernandez. The UN brief speaks very eloquently and quite instructively on the historic and deep-seated nature of racism in the U.S. criminal justice system, as well as the civil justice system. One of the things that's been, I would argue, most overlooked in this case, there's been a lot of focus, and rightfully, on the improprieties of police and prosecutors, but very little on the judges that have handled this. Judges in this case have whitewashed the racism that has been extraordinarily evident since the actual beating of Abu-Jamal on December 9, 1981 by police that happened even before he was formally arrested. The honorable jurist that you'll hear from this morning is from Little Rock, Arkansas, and the very first African-American judge that was elected to a judgeship in the United States took place in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1873. That man's name was Mifflin Gibbs. He was a Philadelphia native. And again, talking about the brief, it talks about the deep-seated and historic nature of racism in the United States, including the courts. And Mr. Gibbs, before he became a judge, when he was an activist and successful entrepreneur in California, protested against a practice in California that barred African-Americans from being able to testify in courts against whites. So when we talk about the effect that the courts have had on Black people, say in California, somebody's land was stolen, a Black person's land was stolen, they couldn't even go into court and articulate it unless a white person was there vouching for them. That just shows you the long arc of racism in the U.S. criminal justice system. I would like to just reference the item mark number 35 in the UN brief, and they talk about the judge, the trial judge in the case, the late Albert Sabo, and he was specifically quoted as saying he was going to help them fry the N-word. Now, well, many people react to the use of that odious phrase, the N-word, and I think we should really start using that phrase because putting it in the context of the N-word really dissipates some of its impact. But the worst aspect of this was the judge openly saying that he was going to help prosecutors convict this man. He would do whatever he can, bend or break the law, to make sure that this person was convicted. That goes to the core of an unfair trial and shows gross partiality from the judge, which violates a judge's duty to impartiality, which is in the code of conduct for judges in Pennsylvania. When we look at the 1982 trial, this judge who promised to help prosecutors fry the N-word, fry Mumia, he stripped Mumia of his right to represent himself. He stripped him from being able to finish the jury selection. There was a lot of things that the judge did overtly and covertly to help prosecutors, dismissing jurors when he allowed other jurors to have the same sort of relief that he dismissed was asked, blocking certain testimony coming in. The judge threw the trial. Now, when that judge's bias was an issue in Mumia's appeals in the mid-90s, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court allowed the judge to continue to stay on the case. A classic and obvious example of the fox being put in charge of the hen house. Sabo's bias in that 1995 hearing was so extraordinary that reporters from around the world, from Philadelphia to Florida, from New York to LA to London to Japan, criticized the ruling. The actions of Sabo were so outrageous that Philadelphia's media, that was normally anti-Abu Jamal, was critical of what Sabo was doing. The two daily newspapers, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, both wrote editorials critical of Judge Sabo's demeanor and behavior during that trial. But when it came up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, what happened? The Pennsylvania Supreme Court haughtily said, oh, the opinions of a handful of journalists do not convince us that Sabo was biased. Although they said Sabo made intemperate remarks and acted in violation of judicial decorum. Now, let's look at the words. Judges' rulings are supposed to be precise in their wording. Handful means six or less of whatever you can grab in your hands. The members that were on the editorial boards of both the Daily News and the Inquirer were over a dozen people. So that's more than a handful. So we can see the shenanigans that the courts are playing with words. During that 1998 ruling, there was a justice on the case named Ron Castile. Ron Castile was the former DA of Philadelphia, who as DA worked diligently against any appeals for Abu Jamal. Justice Castile was asked to not participate in that ruling because of his role as DA and also because he received financial and campaign support historically from Philadelphia's police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, the main organization that at the time was seeking the execution of Abu Jamal. So what did Justice Castile do? In his ruling saying that he would not recuse himself from the case as the code of conduct required, he went on to identify four other judges on the Supreme Court that had received campaign funds from the FOP, saying, why criticize me when these other justices also received the same sort of support? So here we had five members of a seven-member court taking money and who knows what else from the main group seeking Abu Jamal's execution. I don't think in any rational world, and we live in an irrational world, that would satisfy any tenets of fairness. That's why you have the UN brief, as well as Amnesty International, and governmental entities around the world saying that Abu Jamal's conviction violated any kind of international standards. The issue of Sabo's bias, that particular phrasing, I'm going to help them fry the N-word, that came up as an issue in appeal. One judge, a Philadelphia court judge, said, nah, no big deal. It was a jury trial, so whatever Sabo did, even if he was racist, didn't have an impact on it. Please stop. Just stop. Everything that Sabo did in that courtroom had an effect on what the jury would hear. And if Sabo made rulings, which he did, that kept evidence away from the jurors, they didn't have all of the information to make the ruling. When that case that just eliminated any kind of harm or violation by Sabo went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the judge who wrote the opinion upholding the lower court judge saying no harm, no foul, with this brutal racism as well as a bias for prosecutors, said that, hey, no big deal. And furthermore, we've already ruled on this, because in 98, when we said that there was no bias in 95 and 82, this is the same thing all over again. Well, it wasn't. It was different evidence, but they again whitewashed it. And I might add that the judge who issued that opinion in 2003, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice, a guy named Aiken, years later, he was forced to resign from the court because he participated in sending racist, sexist, homophobic, and anti-Islamic emails on the state computer system. And that involved other judges and members of the state attorney general's office. So you could see how deeply racism is baked into this. When we talk about racism in terms of judges in the judiciary, we see very clearly that this is a whitewash case. It's extraordinary that in all of the dozens of judges that have handled this case, only two have been African American. One was a judge named Leon Tucker, a Philadelphia court judge, and for the first time ever in over three decades of judicial rulings on this case was the word justice used in the context of Abu Jamal when Judge Tucker overturned the case and said that Amamiya was entitled to new appeals. That was brushed aside. And now we have this new evidence, six boxes of material, evidence in those materials. Those boxes of information were found in the DA's office. They had been kept secret and, more importantly, kept away from Abu Jamal's defense team for 36 years in violation of federal and state court rulings and local law saying that materials should be turned over promptly. So what the UN's brief found, that there was abundant racism, and it stated that that racism included violations of the right to a fair trial. And if you don't have that right to a fair trial, then you have all your rights violated. And that's what happened with Abu Jamal. The UN brief says confront and don't ignore the racism. And that is now what is on the table or on the bench in front of Judge Clemens, an African-American female judge. Is she going to ignore the very obvious racism or do her judicial duty to justice and find that there is racism and other violations that are very evident that you don't need to be a judge or a lawyer or a law school graduate to see?
Thank you so very much. The other issue underscored by the UN brief is the Batson claim. And if you are able to win a Batson claim, your case is often thrown out entirely and you are set free or you get a new trial. And the bar for proving the Batson claim is very low. In the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, 11 out of 15 potential jurors were struck out with peremptory challenges. If our attorneys had the new evidence that emerged in late 2018 under Leon Tucker, Mumia would have gotten the Batson claim. Why? Because we found in the new evidence a piece of paper wherein the prosecutor, Joe McGill, tracks the race of each of the potential jurors. So this is the new evidence that is emerging, has emerged, and is being decided on finally on December 16th of this year.
We're going to take a short station break. Stay with us. We're going to continue these voices on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that still keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and you'd agree that every man should be free.
Welcome back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. You can subscribe for a free podcast. If you're a member of Facebook, you can look for us and friend us there. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And in the U.S., we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and internationally to our SoundCloud listeners in Germany. We now turn our attention to the coverage of the press conference held in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the amicus brief in his case filed by the UN Working Group on People of African Descent.
I would like to bring to the spotlight the Honorable Wendell Griffin, who's state court trial judge in the 6th Judicial Circuit of Arkansas. Judge Wendell Griffin.
I thank the UN for raising a challenge to the rule of law hypocrisy that characterizes so much of the judicial rhetoric that we hear concerning the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. Often we hear judges talk about following the rule of law and following precedent. But as the dissenting judge mentioned, Mumia Jamal has been denied the opportunity to gain the benefit of court precedence. The most recent example, glaring, is the fact that 6 boxes of evidence were discovered, if you want to use that term, decades after Mumia Jamal was arrested, charged, prosecuted, tried, convicted, sentenced to death, appealed, spent decades on death row, had his death row sentence overturned, and even decades later, fighting for justice, this evidence had not been disclosed to the defense team. When in 1963, the United States Supreme Court in the case of Brady versus Maryland held that due process of law requires that prosecutors reveal any exculpatory evidence to defense counsel, and that the failure to do so, that concealment of exculpatory evidence, violates fundamental fairness, what we call due process. An earlier case cited in Brady, dated 1935, said that when you have that kind of concealment, you have a pretense of a trial. In 2022, the importance of the UN amicus brief is that it calls on the American justice system, and specifically Judge Lucretia Clemens, to answer the question whether or not she will say that Mumia Jamal had a pretense of a trial. A pretense of a trial when prosecutors were allowed to engage in flagrant abuses of Batson, but also a pretense of a trial to the extent that exculpatory evidence was knowingly concealed and kept from Jamal's defense team for decades. 2019 was when it was discovered. This is now 2022. Why would that not happen? Why, if there is a 60 year history of court precedent since Brady versus Maryland in 1963, that says that concealing exculpatory evidence violates due process. And in Brady, a first-degree murder charge was overturned. In Mooney versus Holohan, a California case in 1935, a first-degree murder charge was overturned, conviction overturned. And so the question is, why not Mumia? Why not Mumia Abu-Jamal? The question might be answered this way. Perhaps our criminal, and I don't call it a criminal justice system, let's stop using that term. It's a criminal punishment system. Its aim is not justice. Its aim is punishment. Mm-hmm. And the reason why Mumia Abu-Jamal is in prison now is because the system is geared toward punishing, not justice. And the people who are targets most and first for punishment are Black, Brown, and radical liberating-minded people. Mumia Jamal can be set free if Judge Clemens is committed to justice and not to punishment. And if she is committed to following the precedent, giving Mumia the benefit of precedent that existed long before 1982, when he was tried. I cited you to a 1935 case from California, 50 years before Mumia was tried. And so the relief that he is entitled to is relief that the American system of courts have recognized as entitled for people whose due process rights have been violated. As a state court trial judge who has tried murder cases and presided over murder cases, I understand the pressures that weigh on judges to defer to public opinion and especially to police opinion. However, as someone from Arkansas, the case of Moore versus Dempsey, arising from the Elaine race massacre of 1919, speaks very loudly to me. In that case, 5 Black men were tried and convicted of murder in less than 30 minutes. In a mob-dominated trial. And Supreme Court of the United States overturned that conviction and held they were entitled to a new trial based upon a habeas petition brought on their behalf. Mumia Abu-Jamal is entitled to the same kind of relief. The UN working group says so. One of the problems of being a Black judge is having to explain to white peers, and I've been an appellate judge, they are unable to understand their own cultural incompetence and how it affects criminal punishment and justice. This is the challenge.
Thank you.
There's so much that just violates what is supposed to be the basic tenets of justice, and that's to have fair representation both by the defense and the prosecution to put on their case. When we look at just the issue of Judge Szabo saying before trial that he was going to help prosecutors fry the N-word, and they weren't using the N-word, he used that word, that alone should have been enough to grant a new trial, because that just goes to the very core of what is supposed to be sacred with the American criminal justice system. But what we see is judges and justices, all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, sanctioning misconduct that they have granted other inmates relief for. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. The U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling that Mumia was not entitled to any relief when he made a statement to the court, which was called allocution. The judge, Sabo, who was biased, I let the prosecutor come in and add some questions in. The irony with all of this, or one of the multiple ironies, is that months after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Abu Jamal's conviction, it granted relief to a member of a white racist prison gang in Delaware who had escaped and killed somebody because it said that the prosecution had made some errors. So here the U.S. Supreme Court gave relief to a white racist prison gang member, but wouldn't give relief to Abu Jamal, where the prosecutor manipulated facts and law to imply that because Mumia was a member of the Black Panther Party 12 years before his arrest, that that influenced him to commit this crime on the night of December 9th, or the morning of December 9th, 1981. Mumia, on his own, appeals to the Supreme Court to look at his case again. They deny it. And then months later, based on their ruling in this Delaware case involving the escaped inmate, they gave the same relief to a man in Nevada who was a member of a devil-worshipping cult who killed some of his relatives. So here we have a clear example of the U.S. Supreme Court giving relief to a white racist prison gang member, current white racist prison gang member, and a current devil worshiper who was white, but denying it to a person who was a member of the Black Panther Party 12 years before he was charged. So there are so many flaws in this case, not only with the original 1982 trial, but through so many layers of court rulings by appellate courts all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. When the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against Abu Jamal, the ruling itself was, you know, maybe 10 or 20 pages, maybe like 10 pages, but dissent, the first dissent ever, the judge who dissented said, wrote like twice as much as the original opinion, saying, why aren't we giving Mr. Jamal the courtesy of our precedent? Why are we changing our precedent just in this one particular case? And when we look at this case, there are repeated and just disturbing instances of courts violating their own rules to uphold this particular conviction. Just one quick example, there was over 20 cases where courts gave relief to persons in Philadelphia in death penalty trials because their lawyer didn't provide any mitigating evidence during the trial. Mumia's attorney at the time did not, and the court said no big deal because Mumia, who was barred from the courtroom, was in charge of his defense. I mean, they come up with the most preposterous stuff, and because they said it, then it should be okay, and that's fundamentally wrong.
We have a question from Kalanji Changa.
Peace. Thanks for putting this together and providing clarity and a concrete analysis. First question is, how do you see the public becoming more aware of judicial collusion within with police misconduct?
Can you repeat that again?
How do you see the public becoming more aware of judicial collusion with police misconduct?
Anyone want to tackle this question?
Well, it just depends on where you want to start. There's so many instances of this. I think a quick primer would be the Amnesty International organization. They did a report on the Abu Jamal case. They came out in February of 2000. It's only 35 pages. It's a quick read. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand it. And that really lays out multiple layers, you know, trial layers, appellate court layers, and everything of what happened to Abu Jamal. And you could see how not only trial courts, but appellate court judges have conscientiously worked against Abu Jamal. There's one passage in there where they look at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where the former district attorney of Philadelphia, when he went up to the and became a member of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, despite him opposing Abu Jamal's appeals as DA, he sat on the case and ruled on it. And they came to the conclusion, many conclusions. one of which the judge who Abu Jamal's attorney said, hey, you shouldn't be sitting on this because you were Philadelphia's DA and you fought against it. One of his responses was, why are you criticizing me? Because there are four other members on this court that have also received campaign funding and backing from the Philadelphia Police Union that you're criticizing me for getting court, you know, funding from. So here you had five members of a seven-member court in the pocket of the main group that was opposed to any kind of justice for Abu Jamal. That type of injustice would probably shock the conscience of even China and Russia, where they make no pretense of following the law. But that is not the most extraordinary example. It's just one of many in the Abu Jamal case. That's why people around the world see this as a fundamental injustice and a blot on the American judicial system.
More people are doing court watching. Mm. More groups are intentionally watching cases, and not just the so-called high-profile cases. There are groups in more and more communities that are intentionally watching, monitoring how judges hold court, how judges deal with, dispose of cases, and what are patterns that judges exhibit in the way they deal with cases. I think this is a good thing. I hope that it happens in more locations, but I would encourage more of us to be involved in activity because, quite frankly, what happens in these cases affects all of us. It has a bearing on all of us. While the individual defendant may be the person who is involved, Mumia is us. Mumia is all of us. And as goes Mumia, so goes the issue of justice for every soul. And so the more court watchers we have, the better it will be for people like Mumia.
Thank you so very much. And that's really important for this coming court date. Julia Wright, can you say how Mumia's health is right now?
In the Mumia Health Committee, our conclusion is freedom is the only treatment for elders who are comorbid, who are in prisons where food, though it's a human right, is actually poison, where there's no ventilation, where it is so cold that the other day in Pennsylvania, a young man was hospitalized for hypothermia, was put back into the same cell and died. Mumia's health is that he has been, since he left hospital for double bypass surgery a year and a half ago, he has been claiming the cardiac diet prescribed to him by the surgeon who operated on him. For a year and a half, Mumia has filed these claims with the Department of Corrections. For a year and a half, Mumia, who is a jailhouse lawyer, who has won so many of his fellow detainees' lawsuits, has been unable to access that diet, which is recognized as a disability by the American Disability Association, especially behind bars. Prognosis, congestive heart disease. A person who suffers from that, 50% of them die within 5 years. But if you're in prison and you don't get access to the cardiac diet, the prognosis has to be revised accordingly.
You can go to Love Not Fear, fear spelled with a PH.com, lovenotfear.com, for instructions on how the movement is handling this matter. I would, as a professor of history, American history, but also as the executive producer and director of the film Justice on Trial, having done a lot of research, would like to raise the issue of police violence and police corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions in all cases in Philadelphia, but especially in cases in the late 1970s and early 1980s. The entire police department in Philadelphia was investigated at different levels, at the state level, by city council, and by the Department of Justice. And again, that study by the Department of Justice said that the level of homicidal violence on the part of the Philadelphia police against those arrested who were Latino and Black, and the level of corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions, quote, shocks the conscience. And of the 35 police officers involved in Mumia's case, approximately a third of them were convicted and jailed precisely for tampering with evidence and corruption in other cases. Jamal Jr. is on the line, and perhaps he would like to say something.
We all know that corruption imbued with racism and other inequalities designed to work against non-white peoples in this country. We know that, right? You know, and that's on paper, that's on media. This is not a conspiracy case, right? This is real. This has been a real issue since this country was formed. And in the case of my grandfather, Mumia Abu-Jamal, there's so many points of injustice that's been ignored by those holding the keys to my grandfather's release. Ignored because the justice system that, again, has robbed so many people of their time on this planet, right? It doesn't want to look itself in the mirror. You know, Mumia is innocent. And if there's going to be any reconciliation in the state of Pennsylvania, like, Mumia will be a free man. This is my grandfather. You know, this man has my father's face, and he's a man that's been an inspiration to so many people a world over. And he hasn't just been an inspiration because of his words, his analysis. The injustices in his case has inspired so many people, right? It made so many people put their boots to the ground. We all have a job to do, right? And it's really getting to the root of this massive